So it's D-Day, yeah?
Yeah.
75th anniversary, June 6th, 1944. And that's when invading forces entered Europe. And in this practice, we believe that the mind is radiant and pure, and it is only when outside forces invade the mind that we suffer. So these outside forces take the form of greed, hatred, and delusion. They're all variants on those three. Greed or lust, sometimes it's called. Hatred or aversion, it's sometimes called. And delusion has many different forms. And that's what we'll talk about tonight. We'll talk about delusion on D-Day. So last week I was here and there was a couple of people that had never been here before, so I was speaking with them at the break. And I said, oh, come on back next week. I'll be talking about delusion. And she said, oh, everyone has that. I thought, there's a lot of wisdom there. This first visit and they've already got it. So it's true, we do. We all have delusion. And our own form of it varies from person to person. But it is all some sort of mix, some sort of Venn diagram of greed, hatred, and delusion, and all their variants and their intensities. So there was a, this one sort of sums them all up, their New Yorker cartoon in the April 22nd edition. It shows a black hole. I'm sure you can imagine that. And it says, I've absorbed all matter within my gravitational pull. I should be happy. I think that's more on the desire end of things. But delusion is present in every other unskillful mind state. So that's something to know. Even when, you know, you're really noticing, oh, I gotta have that. And it's desire that is most apparent in the mind. Know that delusion is right behind that, saying, if you get that, you're going to be happy forever, yeah. Right? So there's some form of delusion always present when any of the others are present, or any unskillful mind state. So there's a sutta that goes into this, and it's called the Vipalasa Sutta. And I like the way Andrew Olensky translates it. Andrew Olensky was the executive director at the Buddhist Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. I always forget which B is which. BCBS. Berry Center for Buddhist Studies before the Venerable Analeo, and we'll be talking about Venerable Analeo a little later on, but he's the executive director now, but Andrew was before him. And he translates this Vipalasa as distortions of the mind. So it gets back to that idea that this mind is radiant and pure, and it's only when it's invaded by visiting forces that we suffer. So he calls them distortions of the mind. So let's read about the distortions of the mind. This isn't a long sutta, it's just one page, more or less in verse form. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya 4:49. The Anguttara is the numerical discourses. So if you're in chapter 4, it's always things in fours. So there are four of these. These four, O monks, are distortions of perception, distortions of thought, distortions of view. Sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there's no self, sensing the unlovely as lovely, gone astray with wrong view, beings misperceive with distorted minds, bound in the bondage of Mara. Mara is this personification of, actually mostly of delusion. Bound in the bondage of Mara, those people are far from safety. They're beings that go on flowing, going again from death to birth. But when in the world of darkness, Buddhas arise to make things bright. I love that. You know, the mind is luminous. The mind is radiant and pure. So we get back to this idea that Buddhas arise to make things bright. When in the world of darkness, Buddhas arise to make things bright, they present this profound teaching which brings suffering to an end. When those with wisdom have heard this, they recuperate their right mind. It's actually a, and a couple of other teachers that I read preparing for this talk that equated right view with the recovery of mental health. You know, think about distortions of mind. Something's off there, right? So actually, Andrew translates this as they recuperate their right mind. They see change in what is changing. Suffering where there's suffering. Non-self in what is without self. They see the unlovely as such. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. So acceptance of right view. It's said that the Buddha did not make any of this stuff up. He said that he found it as if an old city in the forest. Found his way to this ancient city, rediscovered it. And that's what we're doing, rediscovering our pure nature, our true nature, by acceptance of right view. We're not all of a sudden making something up or using our marvelous cognitive powers, which, by the way, don't leave those at the door, but using these marvelous cognitive powers to figure things out. And that's how we come to right view. No, we're just accepting right view that was there all along. It was being covered up. So that's our task. Andrew calls three different kinds of distortion of perception, those three that were in the first sentence, distortions of perception, distortions of thought, distortions of view. He calls those three levels of scale of distortion. So the first one, which is distortion of perception, sanya, vipalasa, he says that we misperceive the information coming to us through the sense doors. So the classic example is mistaking a rope for a snake, mistaking a snake for a rope. So we mistake the rope for the snake when we're fear-based. Yeah? We mistake the snake for the rope when we're deluded. Yeah? There's a rope. We see it as a snake. It's because we have some sort of distortion of perception, some sort of filter on our vision that causes us to bring up a fearful image when actually there's nothing there to harm us at all. There's a piece of rope. The other way around, there's something that's dangerous. We don't perceive it as dangerous. We perceive it as harmless. That's delusion. It's a version of seeing the unlovely as lovely, right? Or vice versa. So that's the distortion of perception. And so it's very important to remember that delusion doesn't just color what we think about what we experience. It actually colors what we experience. It colors what's coming in through the sense doors. So, someone hears a helicopter, okay? I was hearing a lot of helicopters in Maui because they fly around the sanctuary and they go up, I was just on retreat in Maui, they fly around the sanctuary and they go up to Haleakala and then they come back. So I was hearing a lot of helicopters. Helicopters for me are fairly neutral just because of my life experience, my cultural upbringing, you know, I wasn't a veteran of any war where those are being used to go into a dangerous situation. And I'm not a member of a community where having the police hovering over my community in a helicopter could result in the ending of somebody's life. So each of us, because of our cultural background, and our upbringing and all the things that color perception is going to perceive the same apparently objective thing out there differently. We're going to take it in differently. That's because of this distortion of perception. We actually color, we put on some color glasses, whether they're rose-colored or smoky-colored or whatever color they are, the actual perception of the object is off from the beginning. Now, as you can imagine, once you've brought in an image that's already distorted, then the thoughts that are based on that distorted perception, that's the second, what Andrew Alinsky calls the second level of scale. You're taking a distorted object and you're forming thoughts about that object. Are those thoughts going to be wise? Are they going to be accurate? Are they going to be true? No, they're going to be distorted because what came in, the information that they're based on is distorted. So the second level with citta, you know, citta is mind or thinking, mind-heart actually, is how citta is often translated. Citta vipalasa is the thoughts based on the distorted perceptions. Okay, so those are also distorted. And this leads to ditti vipalasa. Ditti is view. Samaditti is skillful view in the Noble Eightfold Path. So ditti vipalasa is the distortion of view. So we've got a distorted perception coming in one of the sense doors, including, remember, the mind is one of the sense doors. We've got that coming in. We've got our distorted thoughts based on that distorted perception. And now we've got distorted habitual thought patterns leading to mistaken views. So the views are based on a distorted thought about a distorted perception, about some object that was just out there being itself and experiencing its own nature. And we've done all this manipulation with it. No wonder we're in up to here, you know? I mean, this is... This is just the way things are. So we're talking here about the delusion or wrong view. You can think of delusion also as wrong view. Although, as Andrew points out, there's a few things that happen before we get to the wrong view that are even more basic. And we're trying to figure out a way to recuperate the right mind and get to right view. Now, getting back to the structure of this, on the unskillful side, sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there's no self. I think you'll recognize there what we call the three characteristics of experience. So the first one, no change in the changing. So the changing is anicca. The changing is impermanence. So we're not realizing impermanence when it's right in front of our eyes. Sensing pleasure in suffering, we're not recognizing dukkha, right? When it's right there in front of our eyes. And assuming self when there's no self, that's anatta. No self is not self is anatta. So what we have here is a really basic guide to what's skillful and what's not skillful, what's wholesome and what's not wholesome, what is wrong view and what's right view. So wrong view is not understanding these three things. Right view is understanding these three characteristics. And we call this insight practice. When you dig down a little bit, ultimately, what we're looking for insight into is the nature of these three characteristics. It's to really get past this triple layer of distortion to the way things really are. You've probably heard people say, oh, well, Vipassana means seeing things as they really are. Well, the way they really are is that they're changing. They're not self. They aren't about making a me or a mine or an I out of every experience. And when we hold on to any of that, there's suffering. So those are the three insights. That's actually, when we talk about insight meditation, that's actually the insights that we're looking for. Now, they won't be that stark or that defined or contained, but they're just as suffering is some version of greed, hatred, and delusion, insight is some version of seeing into the impermanence characteristic, the not-self characteristic, and the characteristic of dukkha or suffering that's present all around us. So Gil Fronsdal encourages us to incline the mind toward understanding the three characteristics, but he warns us that just jumping to a Nietzsche, trying to understand a Nietzsche and have deep insights into a Nietzsche from sort of a position of standing still, from square one, so to speak, or any of these three can be quite challenging. And so he recommends that these insights are best supported by inner strengths that we all have. They all need to be developed, but we all have them. And he recommends three specifically for realizing each of these characteristics. So for realizing anicca, anicca is the changing nature of experience, right? He recommends mental stability. So you'll see each of these is actually like an opposite, interestingly enough. It's an opposite. So for recognizing the characteristic of anicca, he recommends mental stability. What's the other word for mental stability? Equanimity and samadhi, right? Concentration, stability of mind. And then equanimity comes with that. Once we've got the stability of mind, then the equanimity follows, right? So yeah, the mind isn't doing this. For dukkha, he recommends well-being. So I think that's something we can all use. And the form that my metta phrases has taken lately, I spent the first week of this retreat just doing metta. What I do for ease is that I say, may you have the ease of well-being. And that can apply to anyone. And that, I was doing that phrase for Miles in the hospital today. May you have the ease of well-being. That's something that we can all experience. Even in the most difficult circumstances, we can experience the ease of well-being. And we can see how well-being would be a help for seeing dukkha. Because dukkha can sort of, at times, feel overwhelming or overly challenging, so we don't want to go there. Steve Armstrong has a saying that shamatha practice or concentration practice brings us closer to sukha, which is happiness. Happy, he calls it happy comfort of body and mind. Insight practice brings us closer to dukkha, right? But the thing to remember is that insight allows us to get close to dukkha because we're experiencing it with awareness. We are not lost in the suffering and overwhelmed by it, or, next step, lost in the suffering of our overreaction to it, right? So we have dukkha, we have just plain old suffering. I mean, you know, bodily pain, mental anxiety, these sort of things, just standard issue dukkha suffering that, you know, all of us experience every day. Just try sitting still for an hour, see what comes up. Trust me, it's dukkha. But if we can do that with awareness and actually be there with the suffering and understand, oh, causes and conditions have allowed bodily pain to arise. You can be there with awareness around that. Awareness of dukkha is not the same as being inside of dukkha with no awareness. Okay? So, and a variant of that is that awareness of an unwholesome state is wholesome. Awareness of anger is a wholesome state of mind. Being lost in anger, blind rage, so blind rage, no awareness, unskillful, likely to lead to speech, action that we're going to regret and that's going to cause harm. That's the definition of skillful, unskillful, right? Does it cause harm? Does it lead to freedom? Does it cause suffering? Does it lead to freedom? That's what we're using. These aren't, you know, some sort of absolute moral terms, okay? Skillful, unskillful, wholesome, unwholesome, right view, not right view. Don't want to say wrong, because we'll get into that moral territory again. But how do we recognize that? Where does it lead? Okay. So awareness of an unskillful mind state is skillful. So the fact that anger is present, the fact that aversion to this bodily pain is present, if we can be aware that the aversion to the bodily pain is present and make awareness the object of our, make the aversion the object of our awareness rather than the bodily pain. Because what happens when the sensing mind is here, the citta, the mind heart is here, and the pain is here, and we're focused on the pain, and this is the object of our awareness, and in between is a filter of aversion. We're not seeing things the way they are. We're seeing the pain. We're doing it with aversion that's in the back of the mind because it's not being held in awareness. And so we're suffering. We're suffering because we are being averse. So being averse is different than being aware of aversion. Because what happens in that case, the pain's back here, the awareness is here. Now we take this as the object. This aversion is now the object. Oh, what does aversion feel like in the mind? What's it feel like in the body? What's aversion, how does aversion color my perception of pain?
Resistance.
Yeah. And what happens? When aversion is present in the mind, all we notice is the unpleasant characteristics of that, or qualities, the unpleasant characteristics of the object. When aversion is present in the mind, all we notice is the unpleasant aspects of bodily pain. Okay? When acceptance is present, well, let's stick with the unskillful states. When desire is present in the mind, all we notice is the pleasant about any object. The classic example Steve always uses is when we fall in love. You know, this person is perfect and they can't do anything wrong and, you know. Soon we find out that that's not true. Hopefully by then something deeper than just infatuation has developed. But when there's infatuation, that's desire without awareness, right? Falling in love, right? You just plop, piece of a gelatinous mass on the ground. So that, there's no awareness, desire is present, all we see is the pleasant. Oh, the sound of your voice is so sweet, everything you say is perfect, you know. You probably don't even have any bodily functions. So we soon find out that's not true. Hopefully by then there's an actual relationship that's developed. So it's helpful to know that this filter, this distortion of perception works quite lawfully. Causes and conditions are pretty consistent the way they play out. So if desire is present, always sees the pleasant. Aversion is present, always sees the unpleasant. When delusion is present, we don't know what we're seeing, right? And there's two versions of that. There's two versions of not knowing what we're seeing. One is we see it and we misperceive it. We see the snake and we think it's a rope. See the rope and we think it's a snake. Okay? Misperception. The other one is that other version of ignorance called ignorance. So we see what's there, whether that's old age, sickness, and death, or our own poor habits, or whatever it might be, and we willfully close our eyes to it. We, in a sense, look the other way. You know, sort of like 2-year-old, oh, it's not there anymore. I've covered my eyes. I've looked the other way. Therefore, it's disappeared. And, you know, once we become 3 or 4, we figure out that strategy doesn't actually work. If we're going to play hide and go seek, we have to actually go behind the couch. We can't just cover our eyes in full sight of everyone, right? But, I mean, it sounds funny, but that's what we do. That's what we so-called adults do. We think because we don't look at something, it's not there. You know, whether that's our own unskillful patterns or that horrible thing that we said to somebody yesterday. It's like, if we just don't think about that, it'll go away. That's not true. So that's ignorance. So delusion has these couple of different ways of distorting perception, sort of versions of what Andrew talked about. So, and then the unlovely is lovely. We don't really need to go into too much here because I want to keep us focused on the three characteristics, partly because when we talk about wisdom in a couple months, that's what we'll be talking about. Varieties of wisdom, and then, well, what actually is wisdom? And spoiler alert, it's not what you know. So the title is probably going to be something like Wisdom, It's Not What You Think. But just as ignorance can be both not having information, which actually isn't that big a deal in this practice, you can always get information. So the very fact that you don't have some information very seldom leads to suffering. But not understanding what you're seeing or ignoring what you see and are afraid to understand, that's a problem. Okay. So we'll talk about that some more when we get to wisdom. And then to continue, Gil says that the best mental support for understanding anatta, or the not-self characteristic, is confidence. Really getting the idea that this whole I, me, and mine construct that I've been assuming is real my whole life isn't, can be quite destabilizing. And so if we have a baseline of confidence in the practice, in the teacher, in ourselves as practitioners, that's going to allow the mind to open to that truth a little more easily. And generally, and I found this to be true in my own practice, generally the mind doesn't open to these things when we're not ready for them. I mean, or the other way of thinking of it is that we don't actually achieve something. Just the causes and conditions build, and then we fall into it. We fall into these understandings, these insights. Trungpa Rinpoche said, Nibbana is an accident, and practice makes us more accident prone. So it's not something that we get, not something to achieve. As Steve said, whatever Nibbana is, we don't know. But whatever you think it is, It's not that. So we need confidence to move forward. And Gill, in his typical fashion, pointing to practice, even though he's an amazing scholar, says that we need these three things: mental stability for Nietzsche, well-being for Dukkha, and confidence for Anatta, to keep them, these understandings, from being intellectual or discouraging, rather than directly experienced and understood. So these are experiences that are in the realm of direct experience in the body and mind. They aren't something that we figure out with the cognitive intellect. Again, even though knowing something and being able to frame your experience is helpful. And we'll talk, when we talk about wisdom, we'll talk about three kinds of wisdom and how they interplay and support each other. So my boss once told me that I'm very convincing when I'm wrong, which I guess means that I've been deluded at some point in my life. So I was on this retreat, and there was a specified day to do your laundry. This is for longer retreats. So I was there for 3 weeks, but they actually, Stephen Kamala cut me a deal. They allowed me to come for 3 weeks. They really prefer a month or longer, but they let me go for 3 weeks. So depending on where you're staying, that determines your laundry day. So Mondays were my laundry day. I was staying in Skyview Cottage. So Monday, posted right in the laundry room, Skyview Cottage, Monday, 7 to 11. So after the morning sitting at 8 o'clock, the group sitting, I go up to my kuti, get my laundry basket, dash over to the laundry room, and I hear voices. And they're coming from the laundry room, which is just this open area underneath the cottage. Thought, so I kind of hung back. And the cook came out and started walking over to the ohana where Steve and Kamala live. And then the handyman came out with a basket full of laundry and started hanging it up. So I said, oh, hi. So he's hanging up his laundry. I go in. There's another load of laundry running in my washing machine, in my time slot. And if I don't get it done in my time, I'm going to have to wait another week, because it's got to be between 7 and 11 on Mondays. So I carried that story around luckily this washing machine was one of those that tells you exactly how long it's going to be, hour and 42 minutes. So I thought, perfect, planned this and that, and planning mind, and okay, come back an hour and 43 minutes, and sure enough, the laundry's done. I take it out and put the laundry back. Well, I had made up this whole story about how, oh, these people, how can they not go by the schedule? And besides that, that cook should know better. She's been here a while, and he did a laundry, but maybe he knew we were down sitting, but she put her laundry in after that, because she was down in the sitting with us, and what's she doing putting her laundry in there right in the middle of my 7 to 11 time slot? So they have a bag there. If somebody's laundry's in there and the laundry's done, you just take it out, you take the laundry and you put it in. Open it out, it's all guy's clothes. It wasn't her. She was just chatting with him. She had nothing to do with laundry. Nothing. She never even thought about doing her laundry on a Monday between 7 and 11. And I had her breaking every rule in the book, And that rattled around. Here I am on retreat. Why aren't I just down there meditating? But that thing is rattling around. How am I going to get my laundry done? I was the only yogi there, I could have worn stinky clothes for 3 weeks and nobody would have noticed except Kamala and Steve, right? The mind. Isn't it just something else? So it's when visited by these forces that we suffer. And, that wasn't terrible, but I could have been doing better things with my heart and mind than blaming the cook for doing her laundry at the wrong time, especially since she didn't, right? So I luckily I didn't go on to a view, so I had a misperceived perception
Laundry in the washing machine belongs to the cook. So distorted perception, wrong thought. What's that cook doing her laundry on a Monday? You know, luckily that didn't turn into a view. All cooks do their laundry at the wrong time. I could have done that. There are any number of ways that could have formed into a wrong view, right? Because there was a wrong perception and a wrong thought already in the mind. Conditions there were ready. But I went back to practicing, let that thing rattle around, became aware that it was rattling around, became aware that I was averse to what was happening, right? And it started to calm down. And when I got my laundry into the machine and turned it on, then I was really okay. That's pretty pathetic, right? In these perfect conditions, and I have to have outside circumstances to make me happy. So I had another funny one on this retreat. So I was very lucky there was a full moon right in the middle of the retreat. And just as an ad, Boogie Phelps, John Boogie Phelps, does a lot of practice over at Abhayagiri Monastery. And so last time I did a Nuposatha evening, a full moon evening, we got chatting a little bit. And so Boogie and I are going to do a full moon practice evening at my next talk because it's full moon. So August 15th. So after it's over, we'll take a little break, a little tea break or whatever, and then we'll just practice as long as we can last. Last time we went to midnight, so we'll see. But anyway, it was full moon. The first week it rained 6 inches, so couldn't see the moon. Day before the full moon, looked up and there was the moon. So at this point I was keeping pretty long hours awake and practicing. So, out under the full moon walking, it was fantastic, or the almost full moon, looked full. Next day it was actually full, I found out when I got back on the calendar. And then for all the succeeding days after that, until it switched to the morning when it just got too late when the moon rose, so I started walking with the full moon in the morning. And I was walking one day, and you're probably going to think I'm crazy, because I did. And I'm walking, and I get to the end, and the moon was behind me, and my shadow was, moon shadow, was cast on the ground. And I looked at that shadow, and I realized, that picture that's there, I'm not looking in a mirror. That shadow, that picture right there, that's the back of my head. When I'd looked at shadows before, I always pictured as being myself, my face looking back up at me. That's not what it is. It's the back of your head, right? Because you're looking this way. What the moon is seeing is the back of your head. It's the back of my head. So then every time I do the walking, I'd come down and I'd see the back of my head from then on. The thing about insight, and this isn't profound or anything, I'm not saying I got anatta by seeing the back of my head instead of my face, but the thing about insight that illustrates that's true is that once you get it, you can't unget it. Once I learned that I had a pattern of blame, you can't unlearn that. And so I told Kamala in one of my interviews, I said, that whole incident with the laundry, that blame thing was there. I was blaming the cook. I said, I thought I got rid of that when I saw it the first time. She says, well, no, you're more easily aware of the pattern of blame, but it's still there, right? And I caught it before I never felt any resentment against her as a person or anything like that. I just wanted to get my laundry done, okay? So, but once you get something, you don't unget it. In this tradition, I've totally forgotten all the chess openings I ever learned as a kid, but that's different. That's cognitive knowledge. This is, once I get that I have a pattern of blame, which was like the flip side of the resentment of being blamed. But that's what I thought it was being blamed that was the problem until I saw that the problem was that I blame others. Once you get that, you don't unget it.
Okay? So once you get some little tiny understanding that, this is dukkha, there is suffering. You don't unget that. That stays with you. Okay? It may not always be in the forefront or, you know, the dominant thing in your mind, but when you need it, it will be there. When you need that understanding, it will be there. It will come back for you. So what we're looking for is the ability to recognize the unique flavor of every experience. So how is joy different than equanimity? How is contentment different than tranquility? How is anger different from lust? Each of those has a unique flavor, some combination of the way it manifests in our mind and body, and it's not, again, it's not going to be the same for everyone. The way it manifests in our own system, our mind-body system, what follows behind it, what kind of conditions set it up for us, you know? Each of us has a different set of causes and conditions for all of our various unskillful and skillful mind states. Those can change over time, but, and, you know, hopefully the bar gets a lot higher for the unskillful ones and the bar gets a lot lower for the skillful ones because we've learned how to cultivate them, the skillful ones, and how to abandon and refrain from the unskillful ones. So that'll shift, it'll change with time. But we each have those. But before we can do that, we need to learn the unique flavor of each one. It's called sabhava, the unique flavor of experience. And that's why we need this intimacy that I was talking about in the guided meditation. We don't want to be across the street looking at our experience. We actually want awareness to be inside of our experience. Not in the sense that we're sort of unaware and we're, you know, absorbed in the experience, but we want to be inside the experience, so we're actually experiencing it from the inside, not from the outside. Whether that's the breath, whether that's resentment, whether that's joy, whatever it is, whatever experience it is, we want that awareness to be there in a way that is intimate with it, that's actually rubbing the experience. The word in Pali, that's one of the five factors of samadhi, of concentration, is to rub. That's the basis for the word. To actually rub. And I think we did this last time, but let's do it again. Take the palm of your hand and just take a finger or a couple of fingers and just move it around as lightly as possible, as light as you can, without actually having the finger lift off the palm. And you feel all that texture, all the lines, all the bumps. And now take it and press a little bit harder. And now press really hard. So the same degree of sensitivity there, same kind of feeling, it's gone away, right? That's the kind of awareness we're looking for. Very light. So it's inside the experience, but it's very light. It's just touching, rubbing the experience. It's not furrowed brow, right? Focused, grabbing the object, squeezing the life out of it. The analogy that's used is holding a dove, right? Want to hold it so that it's not flying around, it's not flapping around, it feels secure, but it's calm. You're not squishing it, but you're not letting it go. That's the analogy. So I'll close with Nisargadatta. He was a cigarette seller in India, And when you do this, notice how the mind can shift back and forth between the hand and the finger. So he was doing that. He says sometimes he was doing this with the finger and thumb. He said sometimes the thumb is the perceiver and sometimes it's the perceived. And then he said, love tells me I am everything. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. And between these two, my life flows. So I've sort of gone on tonight. And I said we would have a bit of an extended metta, so let's just do that now. So just recognizing that even those of us who are privileged in this society have suffering in our lives in various forms. Separation from those we love, getting what we don't want, and in any given moment, there are those who are suffering even more, body or mind, from social oppression, injustice. So remembering those in our Sangha and those in our personal lives or those on the world stage that are experiencing suffering right now. Let's call to mind that all beings want to be happy and dedicate whatever positive energy we've generated here tonight by our Dharma discussion and practice toward the well-being of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings be peaceful and happy. May all beings be as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. And may we and all beings be able to fully experience the ease of well-being. May all beings be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.